Now join me in welcoming the 12th Dean of Duke Divinity School, Richard Hayes, and the George Washington Ivy Professor of New Testament, as he brings his welcome and introduces our Gray Lecturer, Dean Richard Hayes.
Thank you, friends. It's good to be here with you. I'm mindful that I'm told by the organizers of the event that we have something like 930 participants registered and that the previous high they can find for attendance at the Convocation and Pastor School is a little over 600. So that gives you some sense of the interest level that we have in hearing the speakers we're about to hear over the next 2 days. You may have heard that registration was closed a couple of weeks ago and no more people were permitted to register. And I've had several plaintive requests from people coming late like the foolish virgins wanting to get in, but the door has been closed against them. So you folks are the wise virgins, or whatever the case may be, who anticipated the coming of the message of the kingdom and responded in a timely fashion. So we're glad to have you here today. Before I introduce our speaker, there's one other person I want to introduce to you, and he didn't know I'm going to do this, but I want to introduce to you Professor Craig Hill, who is standing down here on the front row. Stand up if you would, Craig. The reason that I'm introducing Craig to you is that he has newly joined our faculty as the director of our new degree programs, the Master of Arts in Christian Practice and the new DMIN program that we are launching here in the Divinity School. I'm going to say a bit more about that at our lunch event today, but Craig is in charge of helping us get those programs organized, and so I wanted you to know who he is. He's come to us from Wesley Seminary, where he was previously professor of New Testament and director of academic programs. So we're delighted to have him here, and we are very much looking forward to explaining to all of you a bit about these new programs that Craig will direct. But my main task here today is that I have the honor of introducing Tom Wright as our speaker. Tom's prolific writings have had an enormous impact on the way many of us, both in the academy and the church, have learned to read the New Testament. He has helped to situate Jesus and Paul more squarely on the map of Second Temple Judaism, while at the same time showing how that historically particular reading of Christian origins can enhance Christian theological interpretation. And we'll be hearing more about that this morning. Tom has written extensively for both the Academy and the Church, and he's certainly been one of our generation's most effective Christian apologists in a post-Christian culture. He's a devoted servant of the Church. He writes with grace, wit, and power. I'm particularly happy in my new role as Dean of the Divinity School to have the privilege to introduce Tom to you today as our Gray Lecturer. For a double reason. First of all, because Tom and I have been good friends now for nearly 30 years since we first met one another in a meeting of the Society of Biblical Literature when both of us were just starting out as wet behind the ears, ambitious young New Testament scholars. And so it's a privilege to me now to share with you someone who has been a dear and close friend over the years. But more importantly, it's a privilege to introduce Tom to you because he embodies the living witness that we at Duke hope to encourage. He combines in his person and in his work the highest standards of rigorous critical scholarship with a passion for the proclamation of Jesus Christ as Lord of the world. And because he combines those things in such a distinctive and powerful way, it's particularly appropriate that we lead off this convocation by hearing from him. Tom, we look forward to your lecture. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard. I, having been a dean of a different sort myself, I wasn't sure whether I ought to say Mr. Dean. That was how I used to be referred to. It's a matter of great joy for me to be here in Duke. I've been to Duke many times before, but to be here as Richard's guest for the reasons just mentioned is a particular joy, even though there is a kind of a wry amusement for me that many years ago when I went into running things in church circles, several of my scholarly friends, not least Richard, said, "Are you really sure you have to get into all this administration stuff? We need you to be a scholar." And I now, having finally made it back into the scholarly world, I find that Richard and I have passed like ships in the night as he has gone into his new administrative role, in which I wish him very well. I'm always slightly nervous when people introduce me, whether or not I know what they're going to say. I was being introduced a few months ago at an event in the north of England, and I actually had in my hand the script of what the introducer was going to say, but he misread one key thing and didn't realize he'd misread it. And what he said was that Bishop Tom Wright was born in Morpeth, Northumberland, in 1848. And then he continued as though nothing had happened, and there was a titter went through the audience, not quite like what you just did. And the man sitting next to me on the platform nudged me and congratulated me on looking so young for my years. And when it came my turn to speak, I could do no better than paraphrase Mark Twain and say that the rumor of my birth had been greatly exaggerated. Now, having said that, the question I want to explore with you today goes back for me nearly 50 years, maybe 45, 46 years, and has haunted me, really, therefore, for all my life, on and off. And in a sense, rather like John in his letter, you know, old men say this sort of thing, I am not telling you anything new today, and yet it may be new. We shall see. When I was a schoolboy, I and some friends were trying to run a small Christian studies group. There may have been about 8 or 10 of us in the group. And we decided one term, in a kind of freewheeling way that schoolboys do, there were one or two teachers who sort of looked over our shoulders, but we basically did our own thing, that we would do a series of studies on Jesus. And each of them would begin with the word, why? So, why was Jesus born? Why did Jesus live? Why did Jesus die? Why did Jesus rise again? Why will he return? I'm not sure we did one on why Jesus ascended, though actually we should have done. We may come back to that. Anyway, for some reason, I was assigned the task of preparing and leading the second of these. Why did Jesus live? And I have a clear memory of realizing, even as a raw teenager, I mean, if I was wet behind the ears when Richard and I met in 1983, imagine what I was like in 1963, I soon realized that I had drawn the short straw. After all, given Jesus' birth, you could talk about the incarnation, about God becoming man. Given his death, there was all the vast field of the atonement. If you asked to speak about the resurrection or the second coming, there was plenty that you would be working on. But why did Jesus live? What, in other words, about the bit between the stable and the cross? After all, there were Christmas carols that took Jesus straight from his poor manger to his bitter cross. Did it matter that, according to the four Gospels, he had had a short period of intense and exciting public activity at the very latter end of that period? What truth should we be learning from that, other than the truths that we would learn from all the other events? Why did it have to be like that? I then faced the same question about 15 years later when I had an invitation from the Student Christian Union in Cambridge in England to give a Bible exposition. I don't know who inspired the question or what they expected me to say, but the title they gave me was, believe it or not, The Gospel in the Gospels, plural. Huge, massive. In a sense, that's what I'm talking about today. I'm still trying to address this question. Preachers among you, indeed theologians among you, will recognize the problem posed by that question. And it's, in a sense, the problem that I'm talking about all morning now. In many classic Christian circles, including the plethora of movements on both sides of the Atlantic that loosely wear the name evangelical, there has been an assumption going back at least as far as the Reformation that the gospel is what you find in Paul's letters, particularly Romans and Galatians. This gospel consists normally of a precise statement of what Jesus achieved in his saving death and a precise statement of how that achievement could and should be appropriated by the individual. So atonement and justification were assumed to be at the heart of what the gospel was. But the gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, appear to have almost nothing to say about those subjects. There are, of course, the famous one-off passages, like Mark 10:45, the Son of Man came to give his life as a ransom for many. There is one passage in Luke, the parable of the Pharisee and the publican, where a sinner is said to go down to his house justified, in something vaguely like a Pauline sense. But these, and a few others like them, not least in John, have to be, as it were, prized out of their context. There are the bits where we can see what you get more fully in Paul. There are little hints of them, but that's all. And it is assumed that the context in the Gospels is not itself actually the Gospel, in the same way that the saving death of Jesus and the doctrine of justification are the Gospel. And that, I think, is the problem to which, in that invited address sometime in the, I suppose, mid-1970s, I was supposed to offer an answer. Sadly, I have no idea what I said on that occasion. It's probably in a dusty file somewhere in a box. As we move house yet again, I have no idea where that stuff is, so I haven't gone and looked it up. We shouldn't be surprised that it proves so difficult to discern how the story the four Gospels tell relates to the central proclamation of the historic church. After all, in the Christianity of the 3rd and 4th and 5th centuries, when the great creeds took shape and some major controversies raged throughout the church, there doesn't seem to have been much discussion of that question. Take the short 4th century statement in this, that we know as the Apostles' Creed. The second article says, I believe in Jesus Christ, God's only Son, our Lord, was conceived by the Holy Spirit, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead and buried, descended into hell on the third day, rose again from the dead, ascended, seated at the right hand of God, will come to judge the living and the dead. So much detail, and yet nothing at all about what Jesus did between being conceived and born and being crucified. If the aim were to summarize the key focal points of Christian faith, did that really imply that Matthew chapters 3 to 26 needn't really have been written? Would chapters 1 and 2 and 27 and 28 have done quite nicely? Was Matthew and were Mark, Luke and John, for that matter, wasting their time telling us all that stuff in the middle? Were they just giving us, many people have said this, the backstory to satisfy any lingering curiosity about the earlier life of the one that the church now worshipped as Lord? This same point comes out even more strongly in the longer creed, with the longer title the Niceno-Constantinopolitan Creed, which developed in its present form by the middle of the 5th century. Begotten of his Father before all worlds, God of God, light of light, very God of very God, begotten, not made, and so on and so on and so on. And was incarnate of the Holy Spirit from the Virgin Mary and was made man, and again, and was crucified for us under Pontius Pilate. What's happened? Here we have this thing you hear in the London Underground when you get out of the train in certain stations where the train, where the line has curved a bit but the train is going straight. There's a recorded voice which says, mind the gap. That was the provisional title I gave to this lecture. What's happened? Mind the gap. What's going on in the middle there? Lots of detail, filled in new ways, but no mention at all of anything between the second person of the Trinity becoming human and his being crucified for us under Pontius Pilate. Nothing about what Jesus did or why or how anything that he did relates to either his birth or his death. And, very significantly, the only mention of Jesus' kingdom comes at the very end. He will come again in glory and his kingdom will have no end, implying, or certainly can be taken to imply, that his kingdom will only then start. Now, true, in both of those ancient creeds, it says that Jesus in his ascension was seated at the right hand of the Father. At that time, what that meant was that he is, in fact, now God's right-hand man running the whole world. But in our own day, saying he ascended and sat down at God's right hand is just a kind of fancy way of saying he went to heaven when he died, which probably means he's in quite a nice place, but he's rather a long way away, and it doesn't really concern us. And it isn't only Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John who would object to that. It would be Paul, Hebrews, and Revelation, and a bunch of others as well. Now, someone will no doubt want to point out, rightly, that the creeds are the early church's washing line. These were the results of the debates and controversies in the first 4 or 5 centuries. These are the things we Christians had to sort out, the dirty linen which needed to be washed. And then we put them in our official statements, the creeds, to make it clear we've had this debate, we've had the discussion, this is where we now stand. Nobody much seemed to argue about the things you find in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, in between the stories of Jesus' birth and the stories of his death. That didn't in itself give rise to the same kind of debate as the discussions about his divinity particularly. Those who did write books which are sometimes called alternative gospels, the Gospel of Thomas being the most famous, were firmly answered, but that answer was to firm up, no, these are the books we read in church, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And that decision didn't make it into the canon, let alone did it provide a hermeneutical grid by which to interpret those books. And so all that material, the parables, the healings, even Jesus' baptism, the controversies with opponents, the great moral teaching, the Sermon on the Mount, none of that needed to be mentioned in the creeds. If those clothes were still clean, you don't hang them on the washing line. But notice what then happens. At some point, not long perhaps after the creeds were written, the washing line turned into a teaching aid. The list of earlier controversies became a syllabus, with the church declaring, these are the things you need to know. This is what we're going to teach you. When I did an early course, early in my undergraduate life on Christian doctrine, the professor took the creeds as his starting point. And at this point, we have crossed a line. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John say, these are the things we think it's really important you should know about Jesus. When you use the creeds as the basis for a teaching program, they say, no, these are the things you need to know. At the very beginning, expanded rather a lot, and at the very end, in a certain amount of detail as well. And when push comes to shove, the one thing you miss when you use the creeds that way is the central point, that Matthew, Mark, and Luke in their way, three different ways but converging here, and John in his own different way, all say was central to the work of Jesus himself. This is the story of how God became king. To this day, whenever people take it upon themselves to explore or expound the divinity of Jesus, there is at least a strong tendency, a risk, a danger for the theme of God's kingdom to be lost from view. That's a startling preliminary conclusion, which poses several further questions of us about our discipleship, our preaching, our hermeneutics, even our praying. The Gospels were all about God becoming king, but the creeds are focused on Jesus being God. What are we going to do about that? Now, at this point, someone will say, surely that's just what the old liberal theology used to say. Jesus preached about God, the church preached about Jesus. What's new about that, and hasn't that been discredited anyway? The answer is that, as so often, the older liberal theology put its finger on a key point, but then drew the wrong conclusion. All this talk, they said, about the divinity of Jesus, but no, Jesus wasn't talking about himself, he was talking about God. And that was meant as a put-down. Look how clever we liberals are. We've debunked the great Christian tradition. Actually, Jesus was just a great moral teacher, so there we are. That was what they were trying to say. And that was, in essence, the protest of H.S. Reimarus in the 18th century, part of the essentially anti-Christian wing of the European Enlightenment, launching what was later called the quest for the historical Jesus. Reimarus was writing emphatically not in the spirit of faith-seeking understanding, but in the spirit of unfaith-seeking historical validation. This, I think, is how it happened. Very long story cut very, very short. The creeds had pushed the church, perhaps accidentally, towards a position of forgetting why Jesus did and said all those things in between his miraculous birth and his redemptive death. And the reaction, particularly among those who in the 17th and 18th century found the church oppressive and reactionary and socially conservative and colluding with violence, etc., the reaction, particularly among people who had that kind of angst, was to highlight instead the material in the middle of the Gospels, well, some of it anyway, at the cost of the bits around the edges, just to play the same thing back in mirror form. according to the great 19th century scholar Adolf Harnack, von Harnack, Jesus came to teach the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. What about that stuff at the beginning and end? Well, never mind about that. This is the center of it. This was Harnack's summary of a century of liberal reductionism in which all kinds of theories about Jesus' life have been essayed, from Jesus the failed revolutionary to Jesus the apocalyptic visionary, with many, many in between, but always with this crucial element that Jesus was, of course, just a man, not divine, not virgin-born, no intention of dying for the sins of Israel or the world, and no bodily resurrection. Now, as you will well know, this liberal picture lives on, both in the social gospel movement, which has thrived sporadically here in America, and in the persistent reductionism of 1,000 books, both scholarly and popular. And its strength is that it really does try, to some extent at least, to pay attention to the bits of the church's own canon which the church's own creeds had bypassed. Its weakness is that it has neither the will nor the means to integrate that central piece, the why did Jesus live piece, with the questions of Jesus' birth, death, resurrection, ascension, second coming. As a result, I believe, it falsifies even the bit it's trying to do. Most of us, I guess, have grown up with this liberal reductionism in the air, with all those books about Jesus who became Christ, a sort of adoptionism at best, and then latterly with the so-called Jesus seminar, Jesus who didn't become anyone very much except a wandering guru saying funny things from time to time. And with the endlessly repeated popular idea, I meet it the whole time in my country, and I suspect you meet it in yours as well, that Jesus basically came to teach a new, simple, clear ethic about everyone being nice to each other. You know, the nice Jesus telling people to be nice. And the greatly overworn phrase, the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith, which has meant many different things, naturally reflects this sort of antithesis. Yeah, the church has got this great creedal thing about all this fancy God of God, light of light, but actually, in history, he was a chap going around with some good ideas about how to live a bit better. There are, of course, infinite modifications within this picture. It's become commonplace to point out that these liberal portraits of Jesus have an uncomfortable habit of resembling the artists who are sketching them, or at least the artists as they would like to imagine themselves. Faced with this, many devout Christians from that day to this, including many learned scholars and theologians, have held aloof from the quest. Why would you want to do that stuff? And from any imperative towards actual historical inquiry concerning Jesus. Surely, they say, we simply have to go with what our great tradition has handed down to us, rather than play around with all that post-Reimarus historical reconstruction. It was all skeptical anyway. It was all trying to go behind our God-given gospels and to invent something different, something which we preferred. Part of the burden of my song today is that that antithesis has a grain of truth, but is fundamentally skewed. The liberal protest, which was part of the great Enlightenment anti-traditional reaction, drew attention to material which really was there in the church's canon, in the church's own tradition, in this case in the canon itself, but which the larger tradition, represented by the creeds and the great controversies, had quietly sidelined. But in fact, when you get up close, the liberal salvo backfires. Because Jesus was indeed talking about God, but he was talking about God, according to the Gospels, precisely to explain what he himself was doing. Many of Jesus' parables. People have often asked me, how could we tell parables for our own day? You know, it seems kind of a neat thing. Shouldn't we be doing it as well? And my normal answer is, quite a lot of Jesus' parables were told in response to people saying, why are you doing that stuff? Well, once upon a time, there was a woman who had 10 coins. Once upon a time, there was a man who had 2 sons. It's the only way of explaining what Jesus was doing, was to tell stories about God, Israel, and the world in these wonderful, sharp, focused little parables. So Jesus was talking about God, but he was doing so in order to explain what was going on in and through his own work. Meanwhile, the conservative backlash, the let's not bother about history anymore backlash, denying the propriety of historical investigation at all, lest we collapse either into the Jesus seminar or at least into a morass of footnotes from which no sane person will ever emerge. That conservative backlash also misfires, because the great tradition has always emphasized that it's the 4 canonical gospels that matter, rather than the Gnostic alternatives, and it is in the four canonical Gospels, not in some dodgy reconstruction behind or beneath them, that we find the great emphasis on the coming of God's kingdom in the actual events of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, which is so conspicuously absent, not only from the great creeds, but from an enormous amount of the Church's subsequent teaching. I sometimes think you could almost state it as an axiom that when the Church leaves out bits, then heresy happens when somebody picks up the bits that have been left out, turns them into something new, blows them up out of proportion. And that's a sign to the Church not just to say, no, no, don't be silly, go away, sit down, shut up, do something else. It's to say, well, wait a minute, maybe they've actually got something there, and even if they've distorted it, maybe we need to reintegrate it. We need to look and see carefully which flank had been left unguarded, which bit of core teaching had been missed out, where the canonical balance had not been maintained, and then set about reincorporating that within a fresh statement of fully blown Christian faith. And if we do this within the Gospels, we find something very interesting. The 18th century church was concerned with a world of deism on both sides of the Atlantic to prove the divinity of Jesus against the skeptics. In some movements, not least the Wesleyan, the early Methodists, to proclaim Jesus' saving death. These were great things that the 18th century wanted to talk about. I want to stress, these are important for the gospel writers. It isn't an either-or. These things actually matter, and they matter enormously. Despite the emphasis necessary for what I'm saying today, I do want to say that, for instance, if the resurrection hadn't happened, nobody would ever have written any of this stuff in the first place. I had a graphic reminder of this some months ago, back in early March, I think. I was in London for a meeting, and I was late coming out of the meeting, and I leapt into a cab and said, get me to the station, my train's such and such a time. And we got stuck in a traffic jam, and it was clear we were missing the train, so we both kind of relaxed, and the taxi driver started chatting to me. He looked around, and I was dressed much more like a bishop than I am now, with a purple shirt and a dog collar and a cross and so on. He said, so you're some kind of a vicar, are you? And I said, well, sort of a vicar. And he said, well, I said, well, actually a bishop. Oh, Church of England, are you? So I said, yes, that's right. He said, I gather you're having a lot of problem about women bishops and all that at the moment. And I said, well, yes, we sort of are. And he said, what I always say is this. If God raised Jesus Christ from the dead, everything else is basically rock and roll, isn't it? And I texted my colleague back home and said, you'll never guess what I've just heard. And I got this message straight back. What a wonderful line. There's your Easter sermon right on a plate. And so it came to pass. Everything I'm saying is not to say the bits at the beginning and end don't matter. They matter enormously. But part of the reason why they matter is because of what the bit in the middle is doing as well. It is the Jesus who announced the kingdom who is raised from the dead, not some other Jesus, and vice versa. I just want to come back for a moment and say, because I suspect this is where you might be, some of you, or some of your congregations might be, what sort of answers might there have been within the mainstream tradition, the mainstream tradition which wasn't going the Reimarus or Jesus seminar route, to the question I was asked as a teenager or the question I wrestled with in my 20s. If somebody were to ask you off the top of your head, what's all that stuff in between Jesus' birth and his death really all about? What would your congregation expect you to say? It's an interesting question, isn't it? I think the Church's tradition has offered four forms of answer, none of which actually corresponds very closely to what the four Gospels actually say. It may be just worth smoking them out for a minute. The first is that Jesus came to teach people how to go to heaven. I think this is a major and serious misunderstanding. Again, don't get me wrong. The whole New Testament assumes that God has a wonderful post-mortem future prepared for his people, climaxing in the new world of the new heavens and the new earth and the resurrection. I've written all about that in detail elsewhere. But this does not seem to me at all what the Gospels are all about. The problem has arisen, of course, because in Matthew you have the kingdom of heaven. And people say, oh, there you are, Jesus is talking about the kingdom of heaven. We know he came to teach us how to go to heaven, therefore that's what all that stuff is about. But no, Matthew makes it quite clear what the phrase means. It means that heaven, in other words, God in heaven, is establishing his sovereign rule, as Jesus taught us to pray, not just in heaven, but on earth as in heaven. The second expression which has routinely been misunderstood is the phrase eternal life, zoe aionios. We have lived so long with the implicit belief in our culture that our calling is to leave behind the world of space, time, and matter and go off to a timeless eternity, that we hear that phrase eternal life as referring to that sort of conception of an ultimate post-mortem future. But in the many places where it occurs in the Gospels, and in Paul particularly, the proper way to read it within its Jewish context is in the sense of the life of the age, that is, the life of the age to come, which is neither spaceless, timeless, nor matterless. When the rich young ruler asked Jesus, "Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" he isn't asking how to go to heaven when he dies, though people have regularly read it like that. He's asking about the fact that pretty soon God is going to turn around this world and fill it with justice and joy and peace and glory and delight. And who's going to be part of the team when that happens? So that's the first misreading, I think, that people assume that the Gospels are basically about Jesus teaching us how to go somewhere else, namely heaven. John Betjeman, in a rather moving little poem, A Statement of Faith, wrote, "Jesus is God and came to show the world we live in here below is just an antechamber where we for his Father's house prepare." Sorry, that's classic English semi-liberal Christianity. It's not what Matthew's talking about. A second standard line is to say that all the material between Jesus' birth and death is set out to convey the teaching of Jesus. Jesus, the great moral teacher. I've already mentioned this, particularly just how to behave. People in our culture, inside the church and out, regularly invoke the Sermon on the Mount. Just when you'd think it couldn't happen anymore, somebody says it again. I saw it recently in the London Times, somebody saying what was actually advice to our new Prime Minister. What he needs is to set out what he believes clearly, like those three great statements of how to do stuff: the American Declaration of Independence, Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto, and Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. That's what the guy said. Excuse me. You see what he was saying? It doesn't matter what you believe, as long as you believe something and say it clearly enough so people can follow you. If that's the way politicians are setting their policies, then we are all in deep trouble. Maybe we are. But the assumption then is, you see, that Jesus came as a great teacher whose career was unfortunately cut short by people who didn't like what he was saying. Is that actually what the Gospels are saying? There is, of course, more than a grain of truth in Jesus the teacher. Jesus did summon Israel to be Israel in a new way, now that he was there. And that plays out directly into the challenge and the invitation to anyone who reads the Gospels to a new way of being human, characterized especially by forgiveness, God's forgiveness of you, your forgiveness of one another. Yes, of course, the idea of Jesus, the great moral teacher, can easily collapse into that standard popular picture, whether or not it's alongside the Declaration of Independence and Karl Marx, or people just say, well, you've got Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, etc. These great teachers you today would see straight through that reductionism. But would our congregations know what to put in its place? Or would they then, realizing that was a reductionism, say, well, no, actually he came to tell us how to go to heaven? Would they do a one and two combination? In the Gospels, Jesus is undoubtedly a great moral teacher and exemplar, but he's much, much more. Now, a third standard line that people have said, and I'm not sure it's really been offered as a way to read the Gospels, but it's a way of trying to make some sense of that stuff in between, as it were, is to tie those first two together and say, well, yes, we are going to heaven, thank God, but that's because Jesus led a perfect life so that his sacrifice would be a completely valid sacrifice. Again, it's true that the Gospels do occasionally mention Jesus' sinlessness. John does. There's a hint in Mark. It emerges more strikingly in Paul and in Hebrews and in 1 Peter. But the Gospels seem to show no interest in making the link which much traditional teaching has employed at this point, that because Jesus was sinless, therefore his death on the cross meant what it did. I can't see them making that a major theme at all. And then there's a sub-point, which many of you will know, within specifically Reformed theology, where you have Jesus fulfilling the law. I've not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. Ah, they say Jesus, in fulfilling the law, has, as it were, acquired a stock of righteousness, dikaiosune, which can then be imputed or reckoned to those who belong to him, those who believe in him. As you will know, that's been a major theme of Reformed exposition of Paul and his teaching on justification. I just, again, don't see it at all in the Gospels, not least in their build-up to Jesus' crucifixion. The fourth standard line has been to say that the Gospels are written to demonstrate the divinity of Jesus. As with the others, there is great truth here. In fact, though John's Gospel is more apparently explicit to our eyes on this topic, a close reading indicates that all four Gospels presuppose that in Jesus we see the living human embodiment of the God of Israel, returning at last to visit and redeem his people. Of course, our post-Enlightenment world decreed in the 18th century that God and humankind don't mix. There is a great gulf between the two. So that then if you've got human stories about Jesus, that must be all that they are. And then John is just a sort of a docetic fantasy. That's how people have read the Gospels. But my point here is not that the Gospels don't think of Jesus as divine, but that isn't the thing they are most eager to convey. They presuppose it. In this sense, the divinity of Jesus is the key in which their music is written, rather than the tune they are eager to play in that key. The point is not, is Jesus God, but what is God doing in and through Jesus? What is this embodied God up to? Oh, we can see people saying, who then is this, etc. What sort of man is this? But actually, from the standpoint of the Gospel writers, we already know the answer to that. It's been revealed to us at the beginning of the Gospels. Even John, in his concluding statement of intention, these things are written that you may believe, ... may not exactly be saying what later tradition has assumed he's saying. The Greek almost certainly should be read, these things are written that you may believe that the Messiah, the Son of God, is Jesus. That's how the Greek actually falls in terms of where the article is. This, in other words, is the Messiah, not someone else. It is in this man and in him alone that we see the way the living God is establishing the messianic kingdom. If Jesus is the Messiah, then this way, the way of love, the way of self-giving, the way ultimately of the cross, is how God is establishing his kingdom, not some other way. And it is a much later apologetic which has believed that proving Jesus' divinity was the main thing we should do, and so has assumed that that's what the Gospels were trying to do. The result of all this has been, I believe, that though the Gospels are so rich in material of all sorts, parables, moral teachings, remarkable deeds, and so on, and therefore can be drawn on to make points of all sorts, which are basically graphic presentations of beliefs and ideas and ethics culled from elsewhere, their underlying emphasis has been quietly but thoroughly overlooked. And the result is a series of displacement activities, with the church saying, in effect, first, we know the Gospels are important. Here they are in our canon. We can't get rid of them. They're the inspired apostolic witness. B, we know what is important in Christian theology, namely the divinity of Jesus and his saving death, or if you go the liberal route, his moral teaching and example. So, C, we put the two together. This must be really what the Gospels are talking about, even though it's quite tricky to make them say that. And elaborate theories were developed in the 4th and 5th centuries to show that the Gospels portrayed Jesus as both human and divine. You're human because he suffered, he hungered, he wept, he died. And divine because he walked on water and did all those other things and rose from the dead. Actually, if you read the Gospels carefully, you could even run it the other way. You could say the really remarkable thing is that Jesus, as the truly human one, is set in authority over the created order. And Jesus, revealing who God really is, hungers, weeps at the tomb of his friends, and gives his life as a ransom for many. I wouldn't actually want to play those off against each other like that. I'm merely showing that to use the Gospels as tools to prove doctrine or dogma in that way may just not be true to what's actually going on there. Anyway, let me just explore this problem from another angle, which I hinted at earlier, before then starting to set us on what I hope will be the road to this afternoon, where I'm going to try and say some positive things instead of just telling you the problems. I've been outlining, as you see, two quite different ways in which the church has been reading the Gospels for a long time. On the one hand, there have been many Christians for whom really, and I expect there are many Christians today for whom really all that had to happen was for Jesus to be born of a virgin and die on a cross. It actually would have been much simpler if he'd done that. I mean, just think how risky it was to go around doing all that stuff. He might never. I remember a learned professor in Cambridge once saying, if Jesus of Nazareth had been run over by a camel on the road to Jericho, the entire history of subsequent Christian faith would have been rather different. Well, yes. So there are many Christians for whom all that really needed to happen was for Jesus to be born of a virgin and die on a cross and then rise again. So none of that stuff in the middle was load-bearing. And if Jesus happened to tell some great, wonderful stories like the prodigal son, if he happened to articulate the golden rule better than anyone else, if he happened to have parties with tax collectors, heal the deaf and blind, that's fine. That's sort of icing on the cake. We can accommodate that within the scheme, but doesn't really add much to our core beliefs. And equally then, in the liberal tradition, the kingdom of God is a present reality which boils down to a processed or program of social amelioration, justice for the poor, and so on. And then the other stuff gets in the way. Virgin births, saving deaths, bodily resurrections. That just distracts attention from the urgent tasks in hand. And such classic dogmas are themselves, from that point of view, displacement activity, shoring up old dogmatic, heavy-handed systems which avoid facing the plight of the poor. You could thematize this standoff, from one angle, in terms of the kingdom and the cross. For traditional creed-based Western Christianity, the cross is the saving event, but the kingdom seems to have been marginalized. For the liberal reaction, the kingdom is what matters, and the cross, though it can be interpreted as the martyrdom of the archetypical revolutionary, Jesus as Che Guevara 2,000 years early, is simply an unfortunate curtailment of his work. You could also thematize it in terms of epistles and gospels. Much of my ministry as bishop seemed to oscillate around interpreting to one another Christians for whom the gospels or the middle bits of the gospels were the basic thing. You know, Jesus did all that neat stuff with the poor and the marginalized, so let's go and do it as well. And then what on earth was that business about the cross all about? And then others for whom the epistles, particularly Romans and Galatians, are the heart of it. Jesus died so that we could go to heaven, have our sins forgiven, so why did we need all that other stuff? But actually those two, neither of those represents even the authors that they're reading right, and we do need to bring those two back into dialogue with one another. I think it's a major task actually for the Western Church in our day. The point nobody seemed to notice, because it didn't suit either the liberal agenda or the traditional dogma, is that in the canonical Gospels, kingdom and cross are effortlessly integrated. They go together. The canonical story does what neither the traditional Christian nor the liberal has been able to do. That ought to be very disturbing to the traditionalist, who suppose themselves in line with the scriptural canon. The liberal might not be so worried about it, happy to be revisionist, and even to introduce non-canonical books like Thomasine as having equal value. But the canon integrates the whole story. The Jesus who dies on the cross is the kingdom bringer. And what does he have written above his head? The King of the Jews, emphasized by all four Gospels. Is that accidental? Is that just a historical footnote? We were standing there, we saw he had this above his head. No, they highlight it. This is one of the telling points, as I shall say this afternoon. The four significantly different Gospels all agree on this, that the kingdom of God inaugurated by Jesus reaches its climax on the cross, or conversely, that the meaning of Jesus' crucifixion is not ultimately something other than the inauguration of the kingdom. And it is this integration which has been so remarkably lacking on both sides of the fence, as I've said. You can see this problem acted out Sunday by Sunday in churches that, like my own, have a gospel procession which highlights the four gospels liturgically, sometimes actually carrying a gospel book right down to the middle of the church so that, as in Eastern Orthodoxy, the gospels are read not from a distance but right in the middle. This is Jesus coming to be in the midst of us, graphically represented. And it quite clearly, certainly in my tradition, we all stand up for the reading of the gospel. And that indicates a privileging of these four books over even the wonderful Old Testament and epistles, not to mention Revelation, which hardly even makes it into the lectionary. We've had a conference about that this last week. In recent years, I've heard a couple of objections to this privileging of the Gospels liturgically. And these are not unrelated to one another. First, I've heard a sort of gentler objection that when you do that with the Gospel and then read 10 verses, 15 verses if you're lucky, it's easy for the preacher then just to pick up something Jesus said and preach a nice little homilette about social ethics. And the privileging of the Gospel then appears to let the preacher off the hook of wrestling with the knotty issues of Pauline theology or whatever it may be. But I've also heard a stronger objection voiced by some in my own country within what now calls itself conservative evangelicalism. There's a lot of jostling for position and names going around at the moment, and don't worry too much about that, but that's where I've heard this, that what we need is, back to where I started, the Gospel, not the Gospels. And that when people stand up for the Gospels, they are actually privileging something which isn't the Gospel, as you find it in Paul, and particularly his theology of the cross. As a friend of mine summed up that position, the Gospels just give us the chips and dips, the early hors d'oeuvre, the optional starter course, before the main course, which is the cross and resurrection as interpreted by Paul. I could at this point, I'm not going to, but I could do a riff on the way in which the great movements of Gospel scholarship that we all studied in seminary 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago have largely failed to address these questions. And I suspect that actually that's because the methods of those days, whether it's the type of source criticism, it's perfectly okay to do source criticism, but the way it was done and the expected results and the way those results were used were actually in service of the liberal paradigm. Form criticism was not a neutral thing invented out of thin air. It belonged at the time very much in the Germany of the 1920s with their particular agendas. Ditto redaction criticism. Composition criticism is a bit different. It's a sense in what I'm doing today. What is Matthew actually talking about? Supposing we only had Matthew. Forget sources and forget previously. What's this book actually about? That's fine. We can ask those questions. We actually have these texts. Now, this afternoon, what I'm going to do is to sketch an answer to the question of what is this central message. I've already given you some headlines for it, and try to show a little bit of what difference it might make in our discipleship, in our praying, in our preaching. But before we can get there, we need to be sure we're fully in tune with what the four Gospels are actually all about. Let me offer you an illustration which I hope will help. I have tried this illustration on one or two people. One said to me that it was completely incomprehensible, he couldn't make head or tail of it, and another one said that it seemed extremely clear and basic, so I'm going to choose that opinion instead. Imagine, if you will, that you have set up a new sound system in your living room, or indeed bought one for your car. You have installed a quadraphonic set of speakers. Speaker there, two and two over there, etc. One in each corner. But you haven't yet figured out how to adjust them individually. Maybe the remote that you've got is a bit difficult to work or whatever it is. So that when you put on some music, the sound may be strange and distorted. You need to sort out each of the four. I don't know if you've ever tried to record music and seen what happens, but it's really rather exciting if you have a band, an orchestra, whatever, and then you've got microphones at different points on the stage, and then you can play around with them, and suddenly you get a real blast from the cellos over here, or all you can hear is the violins over here, or if it's that one, you'll just get the brass at the back or the woodwind over there. And the thing sound, you can just about hear the rest of the stuff, but you're getting too much. You see what I'm saying? You need to get these four speakers in balance. Now, one of the reasons the Gospels are such a challenge to read is that they are each in their own way doing at least four things which much modern reading, and I suspect some older reading as well, has turned right down almost to zero. Little bits peep through here and there, but nobody pays them much attention. And different traditions of reading have turned up one or other of these speakers a bit. But I'm saying it's only when we adjust all four properly that we get the full sound. And part of our difficulty is that we so often get used to hearing the Gospels in distorted fashion, just Jesus the moral teacher, or just Jesus dying so that I can go to heaven, or whatever. That when you do then adjust these speakers, people say, oh, you know, that's not what we're used to listening to. We don't like that. Please, will you readjust them so that we can continue with the way we heard it before? You know the seven last words, you must know, the seven last words of the church. We never did it this way before. First, all four Gospels present their story as the way in which the ancient story of Israel reached its climax. Or to expand this just a little, all four Gospels present their story as the way in which the ancient story of Israel reached its God-ordained, redemptive, but also surprising and subversive climax. Let me say this again, just in case there is anyone so foolish to be taking notes. The way in which, you don't do that when you're on holiday, do you? But never mind, I'll say it again. The way in which the ancient story of Israel reached its God-ordained, redemptive, but also surprising and subversive climax. Unless we turn that speaker up, we will never, simply never understand what the Gospels are saying. Please note that I'm saying much more than simply that all four Gospels refer to the Old Testament quite frequently and present Jesus here and there as the fulfillment of this or that prophecy. To say that is to have that speaker turned up just loud enough so that you can tell something is going on, but not loud enough really to get what it is. Here is a point which I believe to be utterly fundamental for the whole New Testament, actually, the whole of early Christianity. The Gospel writers, and indeed Paul and Hebrews and Revelation, saw the events concerning Jesus, particularly his kingdom-inaugurating life, death and resurrection, all integrated, not as isolated events or an isolated events to which some distant and remote prophecies had distantly and remotely pointed. They saw those events, rather, as bringing the single long narrative of Israel to its proper goal. And the point of the story of Israel, within that variant on the Jewish worldview to which the early Christians subscribed, is that Israel's story is both the microcosm of the world's story and its beating heart. What God does for Israel is what God is doing for the world. When God does what he's going to do for Israel, then the world will come in on the act. That's the basic presupposition to which they all subscribe. That's what it means to be Israel, to be the people who, for better and for worse, carried the destiny of the world on its shoulders. So each of the evangelists, in their own ways, tells the story in such a way to say, this is how that story reached where it was going. Clear right from the start, Matthew's genealogy, obviously. Abraham, David, exiled, Jesus, got there. Mark says, Isaiah and Malachi, the prophecy that God is finally going to come to rescue his people. He's going to come back to the temple. He's going to do all that stuff. And then we turn the page and we see Jesus. Luke, in a radically different way, but with the same underlying theology, structures his opening so that if you know your stuff, you hear in the background the great stories of Samuel and David. He's pointing forward to the arrival of the true king. And if you know who the great David's greater son is going to be in the Old Testament, this is clear. This is where that whole story was going. John, with amazing simplicity and profundity, takes us right back in his prologue to Genesis and also Exodus. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word tabernacled in our midst, pitched his tent, came to dwell. This is where Israel's history and world history reached their moment of destiny. Note that here the so-called Gnostic Gospels are simply in another world. They reject the story of Israel. Indeed, they reject the idea that Jesus is to be understood narratively at all. He's simply there in fragments, in bits and pieces. Just as the Gnostic Gospels, almost all of them, not all, but almost all, eschew mention of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. Where they do mention it, they subvert it. And I really want to stress this, unless we are constantly aware in reading the Gospels that they are telling the Jesus story in such a way as to bring out the Israel story, we won't hear the proper harmony. My second point, though, faces the other way, not now to the past, but to the future. The second loudspeaker you have to turn up is the fact that all four Gospels, again each in their own way, tell the story of Jesus as the launching of the story of what we now call the church. Trouble is, in many cultures, certainly my own, the very word church has become a sort of a draining of energy word. Oh, the church. Believe me, I've been a bishop for 7 years. I know all about that. Call it what you will, the community of Jesus' followers, the people renewed in and through Jesus, whatever. But the Gospels tell the story of Jesus as the beginning of this movement to which the writers and their intended audiences belong. They are aware that they are writing foundation documents for communities of which they're part, and most likely not just for their own community. Richard Borkham wrote a few years ago a book called The Gospels for All Christians. In other words, that fad for saying Matthew only wrote for Matthew's community, John only wrote in and for the Johannine community is probably wrong. There were lots of tos and fros all across early Christianity, and it's highly likely that even though the Gospels will have originated somewhere, there was much more interplay and interface than we've imagined. This is, of course, better known that the Gospels are the foundation for the life of the church because it's been axiomatic, rightly, for generations, that the Gospel writers are not simply telling the story of Jesus in some neutral, objective, fly-on-the-wall kind of reportage. They are telling the story in such a way as to put down markers for the life and witness of their own communities. That was one of the basic assumptions behind form criticism, having said some rude things about it before, some dismissive things, and that's fair enough. The Gospels grew out of real-life situations they were told because they were perceived rightly as foundational for those communities. In fact, sometimes I suspect this loudspeaker has been turned up so loud that the noise from this corner of the room, oh, this is actually all about the church wrestling with its own issues, has drowned out the other three corners and even the basic story of Jesus himself. And the trick is this: just because the Gospel writers were telling the story of Jesus as the foundation of the story of the church, that doesn't mean they weren't telling the story of Jesus himself. This has been massive in Gospel scholarship, and it's just a silly trick of the light, really. You know, again and again and again, I've seen books where the publisher's blurb says, you know, this book shows that the Sermon on the Mount was not actually Jesus' theology, it was Matthew's theology. You know, come on, why should that be an either-or? Of course it's Matthew's theology. Matthew has structured his book visibly, obviously, in a very artful and sophisticated way. But why should that mean that isn't Jesus' theology or something that Jesus said? It's a completely false either-or. When I read the local newspapers, well, in the place where I was working until very recently, the three top league football clubs, Newcastle, Sunderland and Middlesbrough, and the newspapers in each of those towns would be fiercely partisan. And if there were matches between any two of those three clubs, you could read the newspapers in those towns, and the newspaper report would be totally from that perspective about how wrong the referee was to give that penalty, how wicked it was that the linesman didn't spot that this man was offside at the crucial moment, etc., etc. And if you went to the other town, you'd see the story told the other, but they would all give you the same score. And if you thought they weren't going to give you the same score, you probably wouldn't bother reading the paper. Just because they're writing from a point of view doesn't mean they aren't actually reporting the game. I'm sorry, I can't use American sporting illustrations. If I tried, I would trip over my own feet. I was once, several years ago, in a hotel in Atlanta, Georgia, for a conference, and I phoned up my daughter, who's a sports nut, at 6 o'clock in the morning Atlanta time, knowing that the Rugby World Cup was reaching its denouement and that England were playing Australia at that moment, knowing she would be there. And she told me that England had just won with the last kick of the match. And I found myself in a phone booth in a hotel in Atlanta, Georgia at 6 a.m., wanting to go out into the foyer and say, England just won the cup. I think that's about as sensible as going out into the streets of Edinburgh and saying that Duke have just won some basketball game. You know, what are we talking about here? Why should I care? And I have sometimes thought that's what must have been what it was like for Paul, you know, arriving in Philippi or Thessalonica. You know, I've got great news. Oh yeah, what's this great news? Well, the world has a new Lord. What? Are you crazy? You're going to get in trouble. Who is this new Lord? Well, he's a crucified Jew. I mean, what is this about? You know, which planet are you on? Why should we care? I digress, but I hope you see the point. The Gospels tell the story of Jesus in such a way as to say, this is the stuff upon which we are basing our life. And that means that we should look for and highlight and celebrate in the Gospels all those bits about the way Jesus calls the 12 and who he constitutes them to be, their initial kingdom mission and the fact that they're going to suffer as a result of it, about the reversal of power and prestige which results from the first being last and the last being first, about the tasks and the vocation of the community which gathers around Jesus, about the jubilee, about forgiveness, about the strange reversals of fortune. The needs of the developing churches are many and varied, and you can see the Gospels writing in such a way as to try to meet those needs. Doesn't mean they're not writing about Jesus. It means that we've got to turn up this second loudspeaker. Now, the third loudspeaker I've just mentioned briefly earlier on. It's the way in which, if the Gospels portray Jesus as fulfilling the story of Israel and launching the story of the church, they also, by strong implication, tell the story of Jesus as the strange story of Israel's God returning to rescue his people. It's been popular for 100 or more years to see the explicitly high Christology of John contrasted with the explicitly low Christology of the Synoptics. We can and should now recognize that this is a mistake. We were looking for the wrong kind of thing. We were imagining that for a high Christology, you have to have somebody floating through the world like a Superman figure saying, of course, I'm the second person of the Trinity, can't you see, etc. No. To get a high Christology, you don't even need the kind of explicit statement you find occasionally in John, I and the Father are one. Though that, too, is actually more cryptic than you might think. What you need is, for instance, what Mark gives you in his opening chapter, I've already mentioned this, where he takes prophecies which are explicitly in the Old Testament about the coming back of God after the long, strange, dark exile. Isaiah 40, where the glory of the Lord shall be revealed and all flesh shall see it together. Yahweh, who has abandoned Israel for so long and now will come back to rescue. And about Malachi. Here's Malachi in the Second Temple period. They've returned from exile, the temple's been rebuilt, but the priests are bored because they really don't think that Yahweh has come back. Nowhere in the Second Temple period does it say Yahweh has come back. So they're bringing any old animal and it's all a bit grungy and messy and we've got to go through the motions, but it really is weary stuff. And the prophet says, no, the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, and watch out when he does. And it's those two prophecies, Isaiah 40 and Malachi 3, which Mark takes and says, this is the beginning of the gospel. And as I said before, we turn the page and we see a young man coming for baptism at the hands of his cousin. What Matthew gives you in his gospel is the framing of the whole story with the Emmanuel promise. His name will be Emmanuel, God with us. And then right at the end, Jesus says, I am with you always to the end of the earth. And you have to read the whole of the rest of the gospel in the light of that. And what Luke gives you are those stories about the master who goes away and then comes back again, which the church has so often, and perhaps at a second level rightly, read as stories about Jesus himself and his second coming. But that's surely not how a first century Jew would understand a story about a master who gives his servant stuff to do, goes away, and then one day comes back. This is about God leaving Israel with a vocation and now at last coming. This is what Luke means by it anyway. You can see in chapter 19 when he tells the greatest of those stories and then rides into Jerusalem in tears on the donkey and warns about the judgment that is coming because you didn't know the day of your visitation, the day when God was coming back at last. As I've written elsewhere, what would it look like when God came back? Nobody quite knew. Would it be like the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night in the Old Testament? Would it be like Ezekiel's whirling wheels? Jesus seems to have staked his life, and the Gospels seem to have written it up this way, on the belief that strangely, when God came back, it would look like a young prophet riding into the city on a donkey, doing what he did in the temple and in the upper room, and going off to die. You see, in making this point, it's vital that we don't hear it within the modernist frame of reference, with this either-or of Jesus as either divine or human, and if he's divine, he must just be a Superman figure. The Gospels themselves radically deconstruct the old either-or of Jesus as either human or divine. They offer us not so much a different kind of human, but a different kind of God. A God who, having made humans in his own image, will most naturally express himself in and as a human being. A God who, having made Israel to be the means of dealing with the pain and the horror of the world, will most naturally express himself as Israel's Messiah, bearing the pain, facing the horror. This is perhaps the most difficult thing for us to bear in mind, because the word God has been univocal in our culture, and that univocality has basically referred to the deist God, the distant, remote, strange old man in the sky. Somehow the Gospels have to help us deconstruct that, otherwise we just won't get it right. The fourth and final loudspeaker, actually there may be 44, but I'm only telling you four at the moment. The fourth loudspeaker, which we need to have properly turned up, may be surprising, but without it we won't get the full message. If the Gospels tell the story of Jesus as the fulfillment of Israel's story, the foundation of the church's story, and as the story of the Creator God, they are inevitably and visibly telling it also as the confrontation between the kingdom of God and the kingdoms of the world, if you like, between gospel and empire. At first glance, you might suppose, with many centuries behind you of readings that have had that loudspeaker turned off altogether, that I'm here pushing my luck more than a little. Again, in popular culture, certainly in my country, people say it casually all the time, that the founder of Christianity only said one thing about politics, and it was that Caesar and God have totally different spheres. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. That misses the point of that saying. More importantly, it ignores the whole theme of the kingdom of God. And it ignores what the Gospels are doing. Here is Matthew. Jesus is born with these wise men coming from the east and coming to the wrong royal court. Isn't that interesting? Old Herod and then his son Antipas haunts Matthew's story, reminding us again and again that the powers of the world are brooding just off stage, and that what Jesus is doing and saying is very disturbing to them. Mark is a bit sharper, perhaps a bit more obvious. Chapter 10, the kings of the earth lord it over their subjects. We're not going to do it like that. We're going to upend all that stuff, and so on. Luke, with a fine rhetorical flourish, shows us Caesar in Rome thinking it's time we had another census to clean up our tax business. Lifts his little finger, go and do it. And at the other end of his empire, the back of beyond, is born the baby at whose name, within 100 years, Roman emperors will be saying, oh my goodness, what's going on? John announces that the ruler of this world has been cast out, that Jesus has overcome the world. Jesus before Pilate, one of the great scenes, I think, in all literature, and actually the heart of a Christian political theology. Are you a king then, says Pilate? Jesus says, my kingdom is not from this world. So Pilate says, oh, you are a king, are you? Well, actually, I came to bear witness to truth. Pilate has no idea. What is truth? Tries to deconstruct it. Pilate, the first postmodernist, perhaps. If my kingdom were from this world, my servants would fight. That's not because it's an otherworldly king. Jesus does not say, my kingdom is not of this world. So many people have been confused by that mistranslation. It's my basileia is not ectu cosmu tutu. My kingdom is not out of. My kingdom does not originate in this world. Kingdoms that originate in this world fight. This other kingdom is not from this world, but it is for this world. And then we're left with that picture as Jesus goes to his death and then is raised from the dead. Is that what those events mean? And at every turn, we are instructed then to read the gospel. I'm nearly done, by the way. I know you're hungry. We're instructed to read the gospel story as the story for which, after all, the ancient Jewish story would have prepared us. The ancient Jewish story always was the story of the living God and the dead gods of pagan empire. The victory of God over the powers of the world. This is the story of Babel and Abraham, of Pharaoh and the Exodus, of the Philistines and David, of Assyria and Babylon and so on, and then the great restoration coming in the future. Now, say the Gospels, the community who find this story to be their foundation story, are the community who bear in their own life and witness the vocation of God's people to be God's kingdom people in the face of the kingdoms of the world. And the implicit clash throughout between God's kingdom and the kingdoms of Herod, Caesar, and anyone else down that line comes to repeated and clear expression, particularly in the trial narratives, and it is the trial narratives that are the gospel's own interpretation of the meaning of the cross. We should not be surprised that the fullest outworking of this theme is not in discourse, but in event, the event of the cross. The gospels, unlike so much Christian tradition, particularly within the last 200 years, the Gospels hold the kingdom and the cross firmly together. And when they do so in the service not of a detached spirituality or soteriology, but of an engaged vision of God's kingdom, breaking into the real world at the cost of the death of the Messiah. Those four loudspeakers, when properly adjusted, enable us to hear at last the music the Gospels have quietly been playing all along. We have been singing a somewhat different tune, it seems. Perhaps it's time to listen more carefully and learn to sing the right one. And that will be the theme of this afternoon's lecture. Thank you.